This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Now, here's Frank Morano.
Tell you how irritated I am that I said Willie Mays wore number 44. Now, obviously, he couldn't have worn 44. He and Willie McCovey played on the same team, so they couldn't both have had the same number. I just wonder what goes on in my brain that I could suffer a mental lapse so stark that I would say that two teammates on the same team could have the same number. I don't know. I must have had Hank Aaron or Reggie Jackson in my head. You know, that's what I get for thinking I could think. Ugh, that is going to bother me all day. But bother me not as much as this movement all around the country to have taxpayer money go to stadiums or stadia. I think it's stadiums. Wherever you look. Whether we're talking New York, whether we're talking Las Vegas, there are all these taxpayer-funded stadiums. And I'll be honest with you, I am totally fed up and sick of paying for these stadiums as a taxpayer. One of America's great pastimes, besides watching sports, apparently is paying billions of dollars for them. Most professional stadiums have been constructed with a mix of public and private funding. How much over the last 50 years do you think taxpayers have shelled out to build these stadiums? From 1970 to 1920, we have shelled out $33 billion. But if news from Kansas City, Missouri is any indication, the public may be getting tired of footing the bill. So they recently asked voters in Kansas City and nearby suburbs to pay a sales tax similar to one that they'd been paying since 2006. It would have contributed $2 billion over 40 years towards the construction of a new baseball stadium for the Royals and renovations to the Chiefs' home. So they actually thought, the people that put this on the ballot, they said, oh, people love the Chiefs and the Royals so much, they'll jump at the opportunity to pay more in taxes. So it would have contributed $2 billion over 40 years towards the construction of a new baseball stadium and renovations to the football stadium. The Chiefs, who've been winning Super Bowls regularly these days, they even enlisted Travis Kelce and Patrick Mahomes for a TV ad. And yet, even with that, 58% of voters said no. Now, the plan did have some notable flaws that are unique to Kansas City. The Royals picked the site in a popular arts district that would have displaced a lot of small businesses, which clearly people didn't like. And the Chiefs' renovation ideas, namely new VIP seating and improved parking, it didn't exactly inspire the masses. But the vote also revealed growing middle-class frustrations with rich teams and owners. You had left-leaning community groups that support workers and tenants' rights, and then you had anti-tax conservatives fed up with soaring property values and soaring taxes organized together to oppose tax dollars going to the Royals and Chiefs and the billionaires who own them. By the way, both of those teams are valued at more than $1 billion. And yet they actually thought it would be a good idea to ask voters, hey, do you want to pay more in taxes to help these billionaires get a new stadium? The team said they'd bring massive economic returns. That's what they always say. While suggesting they would leave if voters said no, which is always what they do. Kathy Hochul did that in New York when they were trying to get a stadium for the Bills.
It was not an easy task, but we made sure that we could fund this so this project would go forward and we'd have $11 billion of economic impact over the next 30 years. That's real money coming back to these communities.
Jeremy Aguero, a consultant for the Vegas Raiders Stadium, says whatever they've invested there, big shout out, by the way, to our listeners listening on KDAWN in Las Vegas, whatever they've invested there, it's worth the money.
Over 50% of the people that go that are in there come from out of town. Each one of them spends about $1,100 per person per trip. That creates jobs and wages and salaries and tax revenues.
So these teams, the Chiefs and the Royals, said they'd bring massive economic returns and said they might leave if voters said no. It's a time-tested strategy that has gone on for years, and it didn't work. So will owners start paying for a larger share of their stadiums? Some already have, but they're usually in big markets like L.A., where you have SoFi Stadium, or New York, where we have MetLife Stadium, or I guess technically New Jersey. It's hard to predict whether Kansas City is going to be an aberration or whether this is the new trend, the start of a new trend. And the Hustle did an interesting article on this week. Basically, the headline of the email newsletter, The Hustle, was pay for your own stadium. Don't beg the taxpayers to do it. I'd love to know where you think this is headed. Do you think we've turned the page on a new era in public financing of stadiums? Are voters just sick of it? Because I am, but I've been for a while. And yet, whether it's Texas, whether it's L.A., whether it's Buffalo, here we go again and again and again. You don't even get to go to the games for free that you're paying for the stadium. What do you think? Is this an exception or is this the start of a new trend? 800-848-9222. So results for stadium referendums have been mixed, dating back, you know, the last 30 years or so, though teams in Oklahoma City and Nashville have scored huge sums in the last year. The Royals and the Chiefs may seek public funding again, even after losing at the ballot box. The day after the stadium vote failed, a Kansas lawmaker used several tortured sports metaphors to tell the Kansas City Star, that's the newspaper out there, that his state was ready for, quote, a scoop and score to lure the Chiefs to Kansas. So imagine that. The Kansas City Chiefs go from Kansas City, Missouri to Kansas City, Kansas. Who knows if the taxpayers of the good state of Missouri won't give them bundles of public money? Perhaps the taxpayers of the good state of Kansas will. What's the old saying? What's the matter with Kansas? So I think, by the way, there's an interesting book on this. If you ever want to read about the symbiotic relationship between sports and cities, there's an interesting book. It's available wherever. It's called Kingdom Quarterback by Mark Dent. Patrick Mahomes, the Kansas City Chiefs, and how a once swinging cowtown chased the ultimate comeback. It's about a lot more than just stadiums, but that does play a prominent role in the book. All right. 800-848-9222. Meantime, are you aware that they are raising the price of the postage stamp again? I did a video on social media yesterday. It's still up there on Facebook, but for some reason, a lot of people didn't see this video. I don't know. Maybe the algorithm felt that I was being too self-congratulatory by showing my number 44 ranking in the Talkers Every 100. Or I don't know. Maybe they thought it was being too promotional by encouraging people to listen to this radio show. But usually there's 1,000 views, 1,200 views, 1,500 views, 2,000 views. For whatever reason, the video that I posted yesterday on Facebook, 200 views. So clearly something in the algorithm, and I don't understand how this stuff works. In fact, we may get into that a little bit with Carolyn Gorman coming up in a few minutes. I don't understand how this algorithm works and how they choose what videos to show you in your feed and how they choose which videos not to. But anyway, I bought 3 months ago, they just raised stamp prices. And right before they raised stamp prices, literally the day before, I used all the money that I had left in my checking account to buy postage stamps. Forever stamps. And I'm pretty well stocked for a little while. I do send a lot of mail, but I'm pretty good at least for the next year or two, I think. Unless, you know, I have a party where I need to send out a whole bunch of invitations to something. But at least for a while, I am good to go in terms of postage stamps. And everybody laughed at me. What do you mean you're spending $400 or $500 on forever stamps? Well, now who's laughing? You guys are all going to have to pay more for stamps. And here I am sitting on my stack of forever stamps. Well, not literally sitting on it, but staring at my stack of forever stamps. May get a few more just to, because there's some new ones that I don't have. They have one for Judge Constance Baker Moxley that I'd love to get a sheet of. But anyway, I really think this is getting out of control. I realize that if you look at the price of an American postage stamp compared to the rest of the world, America is still comparatively inexpensive. But I really think the post office can be doing more to generate revenue. I don't see any reason why we shouldn't be able to have the post office offer postal savings accounts the way we used to do. I know that would drive the big banks crazy. No reason we shouldn't be able to do it. There's no reason you shouldn't be able to ship alcohol through the post office. It's a great way for them to make money. There's all sorts of other services that the postal service can be involved in that they're uniquely suited because of their locations and the kind of the unique quasi independent, you know, nature of it, that they'd be in a good position to do. And yet we don't let them do it. 800-848-9222. Let me begin with Charlie. What's on your mind, Charlie?
Frank, I just want to say I agree with you 110% totally with this stadium. I am so sick of it as a taxpayer supporting. They say if we don't like it, well, if you don't like it, we'll leave. First of all, I'm not a sports fan. I mean, I appreciate your colleague, Sid Rosenberg, and he's clearly a sports since I've competed, but I have no interest in sports. I'm not a sports fan. And I can't stand when I say, well, we're going to leave. I feel like saying good riddance. Don't let the door hit you on the backside. In a way, I can't stand what he did. And when he took about all the money they're going to break the stadium as a taxpayer. And the reason why I don't like the stadium issue wasn't something you didn't bring up about this, is many of the players, like both in the NFL and the NBA, they refuse to stand for the national anthem. They criticize the cops that instead of having one national anthem.
Well, there are plenty of sports teams that don't do that, and there are plenty of athletes that don't do that. But to me, that doesn't change the economic equation of this at all.
But right, it doesn't. But I still don't agree with the economic equation. These owners are billionaires. These players are millionaires. Let them pay for more of
it.
I mean,
exactly.
They can afford
Exactly. Rather than threaten these communities. Go ahead.
Right. And why should we? Why does the little guy and little gal always have to get screwed? Why do we have to take it in the chops? Why do we have to pay more when these people have so much money? They'll never be able to spend all the money they have. They'll die and leave their children billions and billions of dollars, which I don't mind that. I'm not a socialist, Frank. You know that. I'm a capitalist. I support Trump. I support the system. I support what we have. But, I mean, these owners, they really should kick in more of the profits that they make and generate.
No doubt about it.
Not require us, the average taxpayer, to have to spend for stuff I don't even like anyway. Like I said, I'm not a sports fan.
Well, I appreciate that, Charlie. Charlie, let me get to some other people here. Thank you. You know, the thing that I would be more willing to kick in another couple of bucks for in terms of sales taxes or something like that, instead of a stadium that is going to further enrich a billionaire, I'd rather pay a couple of bucks extra in taxes to save a small business, to save some diners, to save some businesses that have been integral to the character and culture of a local community. This paying for sports stadiums is for the birds. And I hope this Kansas City move is the beginning of a new trend where voters just say no. And if politicians do it on their own, as they did in Vegas, I hope voters throw them out. David is in the Boogie Down Bronx. Hi, David.
Yes, good morning. I actually called about your guest from the last hour, but let's move on because you might not have listeners who heard her. On the subject of the sporting stadiums, this is probably the only thing I've ever agreed with Charlie on in my entire life. And you might want to savor this moment because it'll probably never come again. But I do agree that these sports stadiums are basically corporate welfare and that we should not be paying for them. I think you might be right about this becoming a trend as long as people are able to vote on it. If it's left up to politicians, I don't think it's going to change. because politicians have been forced to believe that if they allow these teams to flee, they're going to lose votes and elections. So they will always give the sports teams whatever they want. And that's the worst part, because I don't like sports either. And it doesn't contribute to my lifestyle at all. But I do understand the concept of paying for something that doesn't benefit me directly. But I don't think it benefits anybody except for the sports people and the businesses that immediately surround the stadium. I mean, if you take Yankee Stadium, I was in a homeless shelter near Yankee Stadium for 3 years. There's nothing around Yankee Stadium except for a few bars and some fast food joints. Those are the only businesses that benefit from the stadium. If Yankee Stadium wasn't there, I don't think it would change the character of the neighborhood at all. So we really have to look at what or who actually benefits from these. And I don't think it's the majority of the people. And that should be who we're thinking about.
David,
thank you.
I mean, I love that Yankee Stadium is in the Bronx, right? I love that Shea Stadium is in Queens. I think there is a value to having those stadiums in certain communities. And if you can cut through some red tape to get, to get these stadiums built, I think that's great. Where I draw the line is doing what they did in Brooklyn to build the new Nets stadium, where they take away people's homes through eminent domain without their permission, where the government actually seizes your home, private property, not for a public purpose like a highway, but instead for a bunch of wealthy people to get wealthier. To me, that's not proper at all. And I mean, that is a particularly egregious example, but I'm also for the, I'm totally against these giveaways, as we've seen in Buffalo, Kansas City, Las Vegas, etc. 800-848-9222. Richard is in Washington. Hi, Richard.
Greetings, Frank. You hit a note on postage stamps, and I don't blame you. I don't do the amount of mailing you obviously do, but buying the forever stamps is money in the bank, and that's why you're smiling now and your friends aren't. And but I worked for the post office for 7 years, and my friend who also worked at the post office, I told him, hey, I got a job at the post office. He laughed and said, you dummy. And the post office is the most, you were talking about.
Richard, do me a favor. Can you turn your radio off, please?
Yes, I'm sorry. You were talking about different ways they could create revenue, and they are the most unimaginative pig. They do things, one way, and that's it. And the stamps, for the price of a stamp, if you were to send me a letter for what is it now, 47 cents, 48?
47 cents. 47 cents. I wish it was 47 cents.
What is it now?
So the current price of a postage stamp is 68 cents. It's going up to 73 cents.
Okay, I see. But, even to pay somebody to take a letter from New York to Yakima, Washington, it's not a bad deal.
No, absolutely. And that's what I did make that point. Look, to be able to send a letter anywhere in the country for less than a dollar and have it get there within a day or two, it is pretty nice, especially if you compare the price of what other countries are paying in postage. I still don't like it. We just dealt with this, right? I just don't. And thank you for the call. I feel like we're leaving money on the table. Right. There's all these things that the post office could be doing to generate revenue, and they aren't. They aren't. Now, some of that, I think most of that, is because of prohibitions that Congress has placed on them, usually because there are private sector industries that don't want the post office competing with them. Do you remember the movie The Shawshank Redemption? Great picture. Loved it. It's one of those. That's the film that gave us the term Shawshank moment. Shawshank moment is when you see a great picture on television and you happen to flip the channels and, oh, there's The Godfather. There's the Shawshank Redemption. And you have to stop and watch the rest of it. You weren't planning on watching it, but if you see that it's on, you have to stop and watch the rest of it. It's a great movie. One of the best of all time. And you remember the scene where the prison warden is taking bribes because his prisoners are essentially slave labor doing all sorts of work, all sorts of development work. And the warden is taking bribes from people who are losing work to the prisoners. That's in some ways what they're afraid of with the post office. If the postal service can offer you a postal savings account, what do you need to go to Bank of America for? If the postal service can let you ship alcohol, what do you need to go to Federal Express or UPS for? There is a world of opportunity out there that the postal service should be exploiting. And they're not, in part because of congressional prohibition, because of special interest, and in part because of a lack of imagination and ingenuity on the part of the leadership of the post office. 800-848-9222. Troy is in Baltimore. Hello, Troy.
Hey, greetings from the People's Republic of Maryland. I just wanted to say that here in Baltimore, we're getting a double-edged sword. We're getting an entertainment district that's going to be partially funded by taxpayers around the stadium as well. And I think that one of the reasons behind this is these reverse, I call them like a reverse monopoly, these players unions that you can only go to them to get a player. So you're going to pay the absolute top dollar, which is going to keep the prices the absolute top, and it's going to keep the stadiums the most expensive. So I think you have to look at it that way as well. I mean, they have a monopoly on where you can get players. Guys can't walk in off the street saying, hey, I can run that best, hire me for only, $100,000 and I'll do it, So I think you have to look at it as that way as well. And the one call really hit it on the head. Corporate welfare is, right. It feels like that as well. It really does. And like I said, in Baltimore, we're going to have a double-edged sword. By the time they finish all their blue ribbon commissions on what should go downtown around the stadiums and everything else, the citizens of Maryland, not just Baltimore, just because Maryland subsidizes Baltimore, are going to end up paying a lot of money for this district of entertainment around the stadium.
So, Troy, first of all, I appreciate that perspective, and I didn't know that. But given what I just said about this vote in Kansas City where this tax for these stadiums was defeated, do you think this is the beginning of a new trend, or do you think this is a one-off?
I would love it to be the beginning of a new trend, but there is such a political machine that runs some mm-hmm. states. I don't know about every state, but Maryland has a political machine. The same two senators ran Maryland for like 40 years. Our delegates ran Maryland for like 40 years, and it seems like another group have just taken over in their place. And they had to die to leave office, by the way. Not that I wish anybody
sure,
any harm,
of course.
But
right.
They actually had to die to leave office. That's how long they ran the political machines here in Maryland. Mike Bush and Mike Miller. So, I mean, I don't know how that'll happen. If you can convince some young people who've gotten into politics to actually say, yes, we're going to do what's right instead of what's corporate, maybe. But it has to come that way. I don't see you filling a political machine in a state like Maryland.
Hey, Troy, thank you. Everybody in the world has been talking about this Jonathan Haidt book. Have you heard about this Jonathan Haidt book? He's been on every show imaginable, and it's all about children. It's all about Generation Z. And Jonathan Haidt calls them the anxious generation. And he believes there's a great rewiring of childhood that's causing an epidemic of mental illness. And you've probably seen Jonathan Haidt or heard him on some of the 9,000 shows that he's been on recently. But I read a very interesting take on Jonathan Haidt's work. It agrees in part with what he's saying, but disagrees with part of what he's saying as well. And we're going to have Carolyn Gorman, who wrote that very interesting, very nuanced review, join us next to talk about children, talk about smartphones and what smartphones are doing to children and even for adults, for that matter, and some of the legislation that's being proposed to deal with the issue of children being on their smartphones all day long. We'll get into it straight ahead.
The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano. Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
minutes after the hour. Anywhere you look in any direction, there is a big conversation going on about smartphones. And that conversation has been furthered by Jonathan Haidt, who is well known. And he's got a new book out called The Anxious Generation, How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. He's been on a whole bunch of TV shows, a whole bunch of podcasts. One of the podcasts that he did was Scott Galloway's show. They called the Prof G Show. And this is one of the many problems that Jonathan articulated with Generation Zers using smartphones all the time.
Kids really, really need to be spending a lot of time with other kids and with adults, but they need to be developing their social skills. That's gotten crushed. Once they move on to phones, you see it in the data. Time with friends plunges in the 2010s. Young people used to spend a lot more time with their friends than their parents did, but now they spend only a little more time with their friends than their parents do. Something's really wrong there.
Here to help us break down this trend of children using smartphones and the buzz that Jonathan Haidt has created is Carolyn Gorman, a policy analyst at the Manhattan Institute. Carolyn, thanks so much for staying up late with us. It's great to talk to you.
Hi, Frank. Yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
So the premise of Haidt's book is that children are on smartphones too much and that it's bad for them. Everyone says whenever you bring this thesis up with them, of course it's bad for them. What do you say, Carolyn? What's your view having read the book and reviewed it?
Yeah. So Jonathan Haidt, he's an academic social psychologist and has a very good reputation for putting forth really data-driven analyses. There is certainly something very problematic going on with kids because they're presenting really concerning behaviors. But there's a lot of things at play here. Social media is definitely part of the problem. Changes in parenting and childhood are part of the problem. And Haidt talks about this a lot in his book as well. But also our approach to mental health policy is part of the problem.
So, and I want to ask you about what those approaches to mental health policy that are failing in just a moment. But you'd acknowledge that young people are having a problem with anxiety and depression, right?
Yeah, definitely. Look, there's a clear association between social media and an increase in some behaviors that meet the definition for a clinical diagnosis of depression and anxiety disorders. There's also some causal evidence that reducing social media reduces loneliness and depression, and even that it increases positive behaviors like physical activity. So certainly there's a relationship with social media and these bad outcomes. They can be stronger or less strong when you look at it for different demographics. Just to give some examples, for some reason, kids in conservative households and in religious households tend to fare better. Kids that are spending like less than 2 hours on it are doing okay as well. Kids on sports teams, a couple other things like that. There's also really concerning evidence of social contagion via social media. And what I mean by that is social media can spread emotions and behavior and attitudes. So seeing people post things that are negative can make you yourself feel more negative. So there's evidence of social contagion around suicide, gun violence, violent offending, bullying. People also share more personal information when they see other people do it, like medical diagnoses. And this effect is stronger for younger users than it is for older users.
Interesting. So when we talk about younger users and the effect, are we talking about Generation Zers or are we talking about going all the way up to millennials? What are the young users that seem most affected by this?
Yeah, that's right. It does look like it's mostly Gen Z. They are having sort of the hardest time dealing with social media. And Haidt thinks this is because, you know, they are the first generation to have a portal in their pockets. They really have had a much different childhood than older generations have had. And that childhood is one that is not play-based, rather phone-based.
I have a 2-year-old, and my wife and I are both on the same page in trying to keep him from having a tablet or a smartphone for as long as possible. But we have a lot of children in our neighborhood who are, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, and they are using that tablet all day long. And I was over a neighbor's house recently, and Carmine, my son, he started reaching for a tablet that was on the sofa unattended, and it had some game or something on it. And my neighbor, recognizing that, you know, that we don't let him use that stuff, she said, "Oh, you probably don't want to use that tablet. You know, why don't you take it away from him?" Which I, of course, did. And for a second, he cried. But my question is, why do more parents not simply say no to having their child use a smartphone or a tablet? Why do all these parents, knowing all the harms that Height has talked about, everything from disrupting sleep to losing the opportunity for unsupervised play, why do so many parents still give this, if not destructive, certainly deleterious device to their kids?
Yeah, well, I'll just say I'm not a parent, so I can only empathize with the idea that, look, a lot of parents are really well-intentioned. They love their kids. They want their kids to be happy. They may not know how bad effects can be. And I think there's also, you know, a resource constraint here. What do you do if you're a parent that, you know, doesn't have enough time to keep your eyes on your kid? It's tough, right? There's a lot that goes into it. And I think we should try to give parents the benefit of the doubt, because it's a collective action problem also. You might not want your kid to be on a smartphone, but if all of their friends are on smartphones, you know, you probably start to feel awkward about that.
We're talking with Carolyn Gorman. She is a policy analyst at the Manhattan Institute, and wrote a very interesting review of Jonathan Haidt's book for City Journal. You can go to check it out on City Journal's website. You write in your review, Carolyn, that Haidt's subtitle, which suggests a mental illness crisis, is the one regrettable aspect of this book. Explain to folks exactly why. Why is that subtitle regrettable?
Yeah, I am concerned about calling this a mental illness crisis because I don't want to give the impression that the solution would be to expand mental health programming for everyone. That has been our approach to mental health policy in the U.S., and it's not working. Over the past half century, we've had a big shift in mental health policy. We've made it less of a priority to treat people with mental illness and more of a priority to try and prevent mental illness by improving mental health or emotional wellness. We spend a lot of taxpayer money trying to normalize mental illness and make people aware of how they feel and aware of their mental state. The reality is we can't prevent mental illness because we don't know what causes mental illness. So trying to prevent it by raising awareness just doesn't work, for one. And for another, you know, talking and thinking about feelings all the time is often making kids feel worse. There's sort of an obsessive focus on how we are feeling. And I think this is leading to a lot of kids to want to, you know, understand that and give a name to how they're feeling. And if we feel something over a period of time, often that period of time is all that's required to meet a clinical definition of a diagnosis. So then we're giving a lot more people diagnoses, we're making them think about how they feel, telling them it's normal to have a mental illness, and then we have this obsessive focus on our diagnosis as part of our identity. Like, teens are putting that they have ADHD in their dating profiles. So, you know, if you have a problem or a disability, it is harder, we know from research, to overcome challenges. So even though we are in many ways sort of glamorizing mental illness, people with mental illnesses are on net worse off. Their lives are harder. So we're putting kids in a really bad position by, you know, sort of constantly drilling this into their head that it's okay to be thinking about how you're feeling all the time and your feelings are valid. And, you know, it's possible that you have something wrong with you because of that. Now, just to be clear, again, there's certainly something very problematic going on, and a lot of behaviors that are manifesting are really concerning. So if you have a kid that's saying they're going to hurt themselves or threatening that, that's a kid who's really struggling and should be taken seriously. But maybe we shouldn't preemptively be exposing kids to all this talk about feelings. Ruminating on this type of thing is just making it worse.
One of the key proposals that Jonathan Haidt makes in his book is for schools to go phone free. What do you think of that proposal?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. It gives kids a break from screens. It gives them one last distraction in class and one more reason to sort of play with each other and talk to each other in the halls and at recess and lunch. I think it would be good for teachers who could have an easier time kind of controlling the classroom. Schools and teachers are under a lot of pressure right now. There's just a lot going on, and having phones away would be one way to help them. Now, in practice, I realize that this is harder than people may think. There's pushback from some parents. You know, where do you sort of draw the line between a smartphone and a smartwatch? You know, things are complicated here, but I think it is worth schools trying to do the hard work and making something like this happen.
You refer in your review to the previous book that Jonathan Haidt co-authored with Gregory Lukianoff. Gregory Lukianoff also had a review of Jonathan Haidt's book, and like yours, it was mostly positive, but he came out, his own co-author in a previous book, came out against two of the proposals that Haidt brings up here in The Anxious Generation. One is raising the age at which young people can access online services that require personal information like social media platforms without parental consent from 13 to 16. That is legislation that is making all sorts of headway in places like Florida, even in New York. And he also came out against writing laws that mandate age verification in order for people to access certain online content. What do you make of those two proposals in Haidt's book?
Yeah, look, I think they're logical, certainly. So what we're talking about here is it's called COPRA, the Child Online Privacy Protection Act. It's the only federal law we have that protects kids' privacy online, and it was put in place back in 2000. So the world has changed, right? Websites and social media platforms essentially can't collect, use, disclose, or sell data from a child under 13 without parental consent. That's what this law says. Well, you know, all kids have to do is put a fake age in to create an Instagram profile, like a fake birth date, or check a box that says they're 18 to view a porn website. So there's just really no enforcement on websites to verify age. So I think it would be useful to create a way to just put greater pressure on sites, hold them accountable for this a little bit more. I mean, right now there's really almost a disincentive to enforce it. Why would you want to reduce your number of users, right?
Right, exactly. And the other thing that Lukianoff writes in opposition to Jonathan Haidt is that minors also have some free speech rights as well. Just because they haven't reached their 18th birthday, they still have some First Amendment rights. And that's why he's against some of these age restrictions. What would you say to that, Carolyn? Don't minors have some First Amendment rights that can be utilized to do things like post on social media?
Yeah, look, of course we want to protect civil liberties, right? But I think there's a common sense approach to this. I would rather see less legislation around content bans and more legislation around sort of the architecture of social media. And this is something Jonathan Haidt supports as well. Essentially, the posts that go most viral on social media are the posts that are the most extreme. So what we're ending up with is a lot of really extreme, really angry content that kids are seeing. And that normalizes a lot of negative behaviors. Like I was saying, there's this whole issue of social contagion. And so I think seeing some type of change to sort of the architecture of social media that addresses the virality of content, the fact that content can go so viral would be better, especially because, you know, think about being a kid and posting something that you don't think is that bad, and then hundreds, if not millions of people see that. That's just exposing kids to a lot of harm before they need to be.
Carolyn, I really appreciate the time this morning. I hope we could chat again.
Yeah, thanks so much for thinking of this.
Thank you. If you want to comment on any portion of our conversation, be my guest. 1-800-848-9222, 800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight, straight ahead.
The Other Side of Midnight. Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
Give me just a little more time, just a little more and time. I'll surely grow. Give me just a little more time, just a little more and time. I'll surely grow. Life's too short to make a mistake. Let's think of each other and hesitate.
Until the top of the hour, this is The Other Side of Midnight. Going to get to your calls in a moment. 800-848-9222. Thankfully, my son was feeling better yesterday. He's totally recovered. He, of course, did not go to school because he was off for the holiday of Eid, but he's going to be back in school today. Still no results in terms of whether he had strep throat or not. He took a test on Monday. It's now Thursday. We still don't have results, but we've been giving him the antibiotic, and the antibiotic appears to be working. So if he didn't have strep, presumably he had some other infection that he is recovering from. But I'm glad he's feeling better and he's back to his old gregarious self again. And I'm going to be very happy to see him in school today. All right. 800-848-9222. Let me say hello to Mark in Newark. Hello, Mark.
Hello. Hi, Frank. Hey, Frank, will you invite one day a Palestinian guy that we can hear the other side?
Well, first of all, I have had a number of people that have a different view on the Israeli question than Bhatia did. First of all, just yesterday, Ben Burgess was on, had a radically different view. So I always try to, you know, express and have as many different viewpoints expressed on serious issues like that.
But
what did you say?
I know, I heard already some of your...
Right. And then Sorry, go ahead.
I said I heard already some of your guests having a different opinion.
Gotcha. And as far as having Palestinians specifically, you know, I tried that early on. Thank you for the call, Mark. I had Abdel Bari Atwan, who's a Palestinian, on the program. And I don't think it went well at all. I don't think it went well for him, for his cause. I think he actually, in part, it might have been due to his accent. In part, it might have been due to some of the things that he was saying. In part, it might have been due to his failure to commend Hamas, to condemn Hamas. I don't think it was I don't think it helped him at all. I mean, we have had other people, including a lot of Arabs, on the program that I think have been very, very good spokespeople for their issue. But I've invited other Palestinians on the program, Palestinian Americans, like Rashid Khalidi from Columbia University. I've invited him on this program. He's declined. So, you know, I can only invite, can't force people to come on the show, no matter what their views, no matter what their ethnicity. 800-848-9222. Steve, what's on your mind?
Hey, Frank, I'd like to compliment you, number one, and then I'd like to touch on three topics. Can you give me a little time?
Yeah, I mean, I can't give you 4 hours, but yeah, we can give you a couple of minutes, sure.
The compliment, the best person you ever have on your show, I listen to you every night going home. I drive from work to home, and the best guest you have on your show is Dominic Carter, number one. Love him. Idol. Everything he says, I believe in him. But number two, getting back to Israel. I mean, number one, getting back to Israel. Israel, with the people, they're condemning them for everything they do. War is not good. It never ends good. The results, there's casualties, there's everything else. Just think about those Jewish people. Your mom, my brother, my sister, walking in and cutting their heads off. That's number one. I hope they annihilate them.
Right. Well, but Steve, understand though, like on the other side of that, there are folks that point to the innocent people that have been killed in Gaza, and they'll ask you to put yourself in that position. Picture being a mother holding the carcass of a dead 6-month-old baby. And, you know, puts you in just as much of an emotional state of turmoil as seeing what happened with Hamas attacking the Israelis.
And that's understandable. War, like I said, war is not good.
Right, exactly.
And there's no good ending in war. But what those poor people went through on that morning, that I will never forget as long as I live. I hope my family never has to endure any pain and suffering that they went through that morning. But getting to topic number two, bail reform. And they go back to the bail reform because I've been on hold for almost 2 hours. But getting back to the bail reform
I wasn't talking about bail reform, though.
Well, the 2 or 3 year callers did mention it.
I don't think that's true, you know, Steve. But okay, just go ahead briefly if you can.
They real quick. They say that the bail for a white guy is $500. He can make it. And a black guy can't make it. A Spanish guy can't make it.
Well, who's saying, Steve? Who's saying that? You're ascribing. For the rest of this conversation, don't use the word they. Go ahead.
The courts and the public and the politicians are all using the unfairness to people that get locked up for different crimes. Let's take the power away from the black robe judges and make a bail for a gun charge the same as if for a white guy, black guy, Spanish guy, or anybody else gets locked up with a possession of a gun or drugs or anything else. Let's place that right on the table. What the bail is going to be, so when these people commit these crimes, they could sit back and say, well, this is what my bail is the same as everybody else's.
Well, Steve, there is definitely an inherent there's definitely an inherent fairness to what you're saying. Here's the problem, right? If, you know, let's say you make $500,000 a year and I'm making 20 grand a year. If there's a bail eligible offense and bail is $1,000 for that offense, for you, that's not going to be any great stress at all to get to, and you won't care if you jump bail, if you don't show up, and you won't care about losing that $1,000. For me, I will care about losing that $1,000. So the whole idea of bail is to guarantee that someone returns to court. If it's the same bail, amount for any similar crime that people commit, irrespective of their socioeconomic status, you're going to have a situation where that doesn't necessarily guarantee that someone's going to return to court.
Right, and I understand that too. And I'm on the right side of the law. I served 33 years, and I watch what they do with this bail. The bail is this whole bail and this. To fund the police. I mean, it's disgraceful.
All right.
But on the other end.
Thank you, Steve. I'm out of time. I've just got to run. All right. Steve's going to continue saying whatever he's saying. The rest of us, we'll move on. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Until next hour, help control the pet population. Get your dog or cat spayed or neutered.